Yeah, good. Before we go on the record, I'm going to make sure that everyone can hear in the adjacent room. So I have the sound system on. Are there, Carol, are people able to hear in our adjoining room? No. Let's try it again. I'm using the sound system and hoping that people in room 401 and in our other hearing room can hear me. Can you hear me now? Okay, we have good audio in the other hearing room. How about room 401? If not, I think there, at least the last time I was in the hearing room, there were quite a number of empty chairs. So Becky and Carol, would one of you mind making sure, if we've got adequate room in the hearing, in the, our adjoining hearing room, why don't we transfer the people sitting in 401 there, because we have good sound there. You okay, so they have audio in 401 now as well? Yes, all right, good. Will be on the record. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is the time and place duly noticed for the public witness hearing in docket number 13035184, the matter of the application of Rocky Mountain Power for authority to increase its retail electric utility service rates in Utah and for approval of its proposed electric service schedules and electric service regulations. My name is David Clark, and to my left is Commission Chair Ron Allen. To his left is Commissioner Thad LaVar. And we very much appreciate your interest in this proceeding and your willingness to come and be with us tonight. We welcome comments from the public in this matter. Just to give you a sense of context, we've been in this room for the last 2 days with seven parties in this docket who have been presenting evidence to us regarding the issue of the net metering charge that Rocky Mountain Power has proposed to us. And And this hearing tonight is our opportunity to hear from members of the public. Under our rules, you may address us in two ways. You can make a statement to us, in which case we'd invite you to use the lectern here, and your statement would be unsworn. You may also offer sworn testimony. If you're going to do that, we'll have you take the witness stand, and I'll administer an oath. I should note that Chair Allen has asked that I serve as the hearing officer for our hearing tonight. I'll administer an oath, and there's some basic information that would be helpful to us from any of you who speak to us, but if you're going to give sworn testimony, we'd particularly ask that you that you provide the following information, and I'll remind you of it when you're sworn in. But this will help us to have a more efficient process, and will avoid the need for counsel to ask you these basic questions. We'd like to have your name. We'd like to know whether you're a resident of the state of Utah and a customer of Rocky Mountain Power or not. We'd be interested in knowing whether or not you are a net metering customer of Rocky Mountain Power. We're going to take a break at about once an hour. We have a court reporter who's working very hard, and if none of the rest of us need it, certainly she will need it. And so we'll break for 10 minutes about every hour. We have been notified that there's at least one person that wanted to participate by phone. And have we heard from that person yet? We have not. So at some point, we may need to connect that phone into the hearing room. So we might have a little interruption. Counsel for the parties, I think all of them are here with us. Seated at the tables, and again, if you offer sworn testimony, then they will, at their discretion, ask questions of you regarding your testimony. If you offer an unsworn statement, then you will not be subject to cross-examination. Just one other logistical item. I'll read the names of people who have signed up to speak to us. I have at least the first list that has 24 names on it. A person is beginning to, or when I announce a name, I'll announce the next name in order as well, so that the person who's next in line can take a seat in that purple chair in front of the door. Thank you for referring to that for us, and that way it'll just be a little quicker for us to put you in position to make your statement. So with that, we're Mr. Jetter.
I would just like to make one quick clarification comment, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe this public witness day or time applies to the entire docket, and so I understand that most of the public witnesses here are intending to speak regarding the net metering home solar issue. I think it, just to clarify to the folks that can hear us here, that they are available and allowed to speak to other issues within this general rate case at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Jetter. That's a very useful clarification. So I didn't mean to imply that you weren't at liberty to address any of the issues in the case. Sometime between now and September 2nd, the commission will issue a written order that will address all of the issues in the case, including the net metering charge.
And I'm sorry, Mr. Commissioner Clark.
Yeah.
Before you start to call those on the list, I have a written comment from a member of the public who wanted to submit the written statement but was uncomfortable presenting it orally. So if there's a way I can make sure that this gets to the record as part of my responsibility with the office, I'd like to do that now.
Yeah, surely. Let's have a – Mr. Meyer, would you mind just taking charge of this, and we'll make sure that it gets entered into the record of the proceeding. Thank you. And I hope I'll pronounce these names correctly.
Excuse me?
Yes.
Could you introduce the councils that are here, where they're from, and all that kind of stuff?
Be happy to do that. Let's have the council introduce themselves. We'll begin with the applicant.
Yvonne Hogle with Rocky Mountain Power.
Thank you. You might just introduce the person seated next to you for everyone's.
I apologize. With me is Mr. Paul Clements, and he is the Director of Revenue Requirements for the company.
Thank you. Mr. Mr. Jetter.
I am Justin Jetter. I'm an Assistant Attorney General, and I represent the Utah Division of Public Utilities. And seated beside me is Chris Parker, who is the Director of the Division of Public Utilities.
Brent Coleman, also an Assistant Attorney General. I represent the Office of Consumer Services. And with me at the table is Michelle Beck, who is the Director of the Office.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Mike Rossetti, the founder of UCARE, and I am not a lawyer.
But he has been participating in the proceeding.
Yes.
And I'm Casey Roberts. I'm counsel for the Sierra Club.
I'm Thad Cully with co-counsel Bruce Plink on behalf of the Alliance for Solar Choice.
Sophie Hayes representing Utah Clean Energy, and with me is Utah Clean Energy's Executive Director, Sarah Wright.
Thank you. I think we're ready to begin with the public statements. The first name on the list has a note next to it with the statement that he's going to testify by phone. We still don't have that person connected? Okay. Then David Bennett is next, followed by, I believe the last name is Ball, and with initial H. And I'm having a little trouble with the middle name. Oh, McDaniel, thank you. H. McDaniel Ball. So just to be clear, Mr. Bennett, would you come forward? And Mr. Ball, if you'd just take a seat in that sort of, in that purple chair there. And do you desire, Mr. Bennett, to give sworn testimony or to make an unsworn statement to the commission?
I'm happy to give sworn testimony.
Please raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear that the testimony you're about to give should be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Please be seated. So, Mr. Bennett, would you state your full name and spell it for the record, please?
David Bennett, B-E-N-N-E-T-T.
And where do you reside?
In Park City.
And are you a Rocky Mountain Power customer?
Yes, I am.
And are you a net metering customer?
Yes, I am.
Thank you. We're ready to hear from you.
Thank you. $12,555 is the amount per month that this I don't think I'm exaggerating, billion-dollar company would realize each month from myself and the other 2,700 solar users in the state of Utah. It begs the question, why? It is such a small amount of money to be spending the days of testimony that you've taken and the weeks of preparation for these last couple of days to impose such a fee upon us solar users. When I installed my solar system in 2010, and I'm able to generate 100% of my power using net metering, questions frequently have been asked of me of, what is the payback period? Why did you do this? Are you going to be able to make money on doing this? And I said, I've got the figures, I could figure it out, but I really don't know. It's the right thing to do. We really need to start moving away from burning fossil fuels and using renewable energy. And that's why in 2010, I made the decision to install solar panels. Since that time, the panels have reduced, the price to put panels up have dropped in half. Also, when I entered into this arrangement with Rocky Mountain Power, I understood that I was going to be charged a minimum fee. I'm charged that every month anyway. I pay $8.07 a month as a minimum fee to Rocky Mountain Power to have these solar panels, to be able to enjoy net metering. It was my understanding that that was going to cover the net metering costs, and I didn't have any objection with paying for it. In fact, I think if you were to poll the 2,700 solar users in the state of Utah, it's not so much the $4.65 per month that is being proposed here. It's the idea that upon, in addition to our own investment to install these panels, to do the right thing for our state, that this additional fee is now being levied. And what's very chilling is taking a look at what's happened in the state of Arizona to see the significant reduction in new installations in the year since this fee has been installed in Arizona. That's very concerning. We really need to be encouraging individuals to use solar. I sat in on a little bit of the hearing this afternoon, and I heard some of the conversation about cost avoidance. And I appreciate the difficulty, the enormity of the question in front of you of trying to figure out the exact dollars and cents. I understand that the legislation doesn't specifically allow the arguments that are being made about the importance of clean air, the importance of moving away from fossil fuels, to be considered in making this determination. But when you look at the enormity of what's at stake here, I think future generations will look back upon this time and ask, what did we do to start to move away when we were put on notice that the use of fossil fuels was, first of all, going to be limited? It's not the unlimited amount of fuel that we might have once thought we had. And the harmful effect that it's having on our environment, and particularly today in Utah, on our air. What did we do about that? Well, what we can do, and Rocky Mountain Power has done some of this. They've done some good things. On one hand, they have a blue sky program. They speak very favorably about the importance of blue energy. Blue sky doesn't always produce that, but they do good things with that. They provide grants to schools to install solar panels. They just recently did that, and they're doing some good things. But then they turn around and try to install fees like this. They take net metering customers like myself, and the statute says that whatever power we've generated by our billing date in March that we haven't used reverts back to the company. I understand the new legislation directs the company to provide that to low-income housing people. But why do they read my meter in March on the 10th of March and not on the 31st of March? When I live in the mountains and I have snow frequently on my solar panels, why not? I don't understand why they're taking the excess power anyway, but if they are going to do that via statute, why not do that the end of the month when they're supposed to? Because they don't, and they won't. They do conflicting things. They do some good things in the name of renewable energy, but at the end of the day, they're interested in preserving their model, their status quo, their way of doing business. That's what's at stake here today. And as a solar user, and on behalf of my fellow solar users, many of whom you're going to hear from tonight, I encourage you to reject this fee outright. We're not asking for you to give us anything more, but to reject this fee. The $8.07 that we pay right now, too complicated to argue why we're having to pay a minimum charge, why that isn't put on at the end for people that use an excessive amount of power rather than have a minimum amount of power. Not in front of you today, but I encourage you to simply reject this $4.65 fee and allow our $8.07 current monthly fee to serve as that cost for using the company's equipment that use the net metering, and send a statement to the people of Utah that we encourage the use of renewable energy. We encourage solar power. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ball. Yes. Is there cross-examination for Mr. Ball?
Bennett.
Oh, Bennett, pardon me. Mr. Ball's next. Thank you. Mr. Bennett. Any cross-examination? Thank you. Thank you for your statement, Mr. Bennett. You're
thank
excused.
You.
We're going to hear next from Mr. Ball. And Mr. Monch is now on the phone, so we'll call on you next, Mr. Monch. And you'll be followed by Mark Thomas.
Okay.
But just a moment, Mr. Monch. Yes, we can hear you. We're first going to hear from Mr. Ball, and then we'll hear from you.
Oh, first from Mr.
Yes, thank you. Well, I'll let you know when it's your time. Mr. Ball.
My name is H. McDaniel Ball. I agree with Mr. Bennett. Rocky Mountain Power has some programs that are very helpful to the community. I've been involved with a number of the utility programs, and I'm very happy with the success of those programs. I want to speak today to something I read in the newspaper recently, and I've actually heard this before from some other sources. It's not a quote from a Rocky Mountain Power or utility person, but it's worth dissecting. It says, solar's major drawback from the point of view of utilities is that its peak output occurs in the early afternoon, a few hours ahead of peak demand when people get home from work. And I'd like to examine the premises there. First of all, it's assuming that I believe that people don't have the air conditioning running full tilt during the day, that they maybe either turn it on when they get home from work, or at least they change the settings. And that's never been my experience. That I've gone into hundreds of homes as a part of the Home Performance with Energy Star program, and if people have air conditioning, they're using it during the day. In Utah, there's somebody home during the day. There's children at home during the summer, and there's somebody in the home using air conditioning all day long. There may be a young couple that doesn't have children who does setbacks on their thermostat. HVAC, heating and cooling manufacturers recommend no more than 2 degrees of setback, or else you're just coming home to a house that's hot and trying to take all that heat out of the air and change it into something cool. It's very inefficient. So I'm not even sure that our peak residential is at 5 o'clock. But secondly, we're not talking about just residential. We're talking about commercial and residential. That the two of them together create a peak. And at 5 o'clock, a lot of companies have shut down. They don't have to run the air conditioning at full tilt. So I suggest that for commercial and residential both, that the peak period is much earlier in the day. 2 o'clock, perhaps, something like that. I'm sure Rocky Mountain Power knows. They have all those records. I've done hundreds of solar inspections. And in our state, about 95% of them are facing south or west. There's maybe 5% that are east. So that means in the summer afternoons, when the demand is highest, from 12 o'clock to 8 o'clock, These solar arrays are producing, and many of the solar arrays provide software so the homeowner can see what the production is at any time of day, or they can chart the whole day. And they don't look like a peak like this, where it peaks at 1 o'clock and goes down. They gradually go up to a peak, and then they level off and come down a little bit. But that peak is there throughout the whole afternoon, and it's operating at, say, 5 o'clock in the afternoon, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, it's operating at 75% on a clear summer day. So I'm suggesting that it's not really a drawback, that there's a perfect use for the solar so that the power companies don't have to provide a new natural gas producing facility or whatever they want to do today, that the solar people who have stepped up to bat are actually assisting them in the avoided costs. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ball. So, Mr. Monch, Malin Monch, I believe you're on the phone with us.
Yes.
And
I'm calling from Virginia. Happy to be a sworn witness, if that helps the commission to pay attention to the points that I would like to make.
We're all here listening. I think you might have missed the introduction where I noted that you have the opportunity to make a statement to the commission or to offer sworn testimony to the commission, in which case you would be subject to questioning by the counsel for the parties who are present with us tonight.
Questioning would be fine.
So you'd like to testify under oath then, is that right?
Yes.
So if you would please raise your right hand, I'll administer the oath now. And by the way, I'm David Clark. I'm one of the three commissioners acting as the hearing officer tonight, but present are all three of us, Chairman Allen and Commissioner LaVar and me as well. So, Mr. Monch, do you solemnly swear that the testimony you're about to give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Then please make your statement.
Good evening. My name is Malin Monch. I grew up in Utah, and I have a residence there, but I am currently working in Virginia. I have a law degree and an economics degree, and I have analyzed and modeled the economics of network industries for 35 years, most of it at the federal level. I advise Utah Physicians for a Healthy Environment on matters of law and economics. Thus far, this docket has been vigorously dissecting the minutiae of Rocky Mountain's request for a net metering surcharge. It seems to have lost the big picture in the process. Utah's net metering statute permits the solar system owner to sell surplus electricity back to the utility. I presume that its legislative purpose is the same as that underlies similar provisions in other states that allow it. Where it is allowed, the purpose of authorizing sellback at retail is to provide an incentive to stimulate the growth of the market for distributed solar. The sellback at retail component of net metering is, by design, an incentive. It was intended to take the members of the residential retail customer class and to tip the balance in favor of solar investment for those members of that class who are on the verge of making that investment. In other words, its explicit purpose is to treat some members of the class, those considering investing in a system, more favorably than others in the class, those not interested in investing in a system. Discrimination within the class is the whole point of the incentive. It isn't intended to eliminate the difference in cost between serving those in the residential retail customer class who invest and those who don't. It is intended to be a component of a tariff that keeps costs. It isn't intended to be a component of a tariff that keeps cost shares of the subgroups symmetrical. If it did that, it would neutralize the incentive. The chance to sell surplus power back at retail does discriminate within the class, if only the direct costs and benefits are considered. But it is discrimination for a purpose. The purpose is to supply society with the energy that it needs in a way that reduces its social costs and increases its social benefits. Earlier in this docket, Utah Physicians for a Healthy Environment filed a written comment that summarized the latest research on the impact of burning fossil fuels on Utah's climate and its potentially enormous harm to public health. The comments run 70 pages and are supported by several hundred sites to peer-reviewed journals. The research summarized there describes a consensus among climate scientists that climate change is expected to accelerate the heating and desertification of Utah's environment. For example, forest fires are expected to expand by fivefold by the year 2100, greatly increasing the exposure of Utah's residents to the toxic particulate pollution that such fires generate. Increased heat, drought, and fire caused by climate warming are expected to strip the rangelands of the Great Basin of much of their vegetation. This effect will be magnified if the Southern Nevada Water Authority proceeds with its plans to drain the aquifers of the already parched lands of central Nevada and western Utah to supply additional water to Las Vegas. Climate change coupled with aquifer draining threatens to release millions of tons of unanchored desert soils to coat Utah's heavily populated Wasatch Front. Great Basin soils are contaminated with unusually dangerous toxins. These include a fibrous material called arionite that is hundreds of times more toxic than asbestos, radioactive waste from decades of nuclear testing, and mercury from gold mining. Increased heat, drought, and fire associated with climate warming is expected to remove much of the vegetation that now holds those soils in place. by mid-century, increased exposure to ozone, smoke, dust, and airborne toxins due to local climate warming is expected to substantially increase rates of respiratory and cardiovascular disease, cancer, genetic damage, and premature death. It is estimated that by mid-century, 2 million Utahns will be too young, too old, or too sick to withstand the effects of the increased air pollution to which they will be exposed. These assessments of the regional climate damage predicted from accumulated greenhouse gases and their effects on public health in Utah have value in this proceeding and will have even more value if there is a subsequent proceeding to honor the mandate of Senate Bill 208 and actually measure the social costs of continuing to rely on fossil fuel to provide Utah's power needs. Selling self-generated power back at retail is discriminatory within the class, but only if the analysis is confined to the direct costs and benefits experienced. If the focus is broadened to include indirect costs and benefits, as Section 208 requires, the discrimination analysis is reversed. The residential power customer who undertakes the expense and risk of installing a system help secure clean air and water and more moderate livable temperatures for the benefit of his non-net metering neighbor, even though the non-net metering neighbor does not shoulder the expense and bear the risk necessary to produce these benefits. Perhaps more importantly, the company, the division, and the consumer advocate all support RMP's proposal by applying what is an irrelevant legal standard. They all assume that the intent of the legislature is to have the Public Service Commission judge RMP's proposal on the basis of inter-class fairness, on whether the cost burdens are symmetrical for net-metered and not net-metered customers. All three parties further assert that the costs to be considered in making this determination are narrowly defined to exclude avoided harm to the climate and public health, arguing that this narrow definition of avoided cost is required by the outcome of the avoided cost docket. This is not a plausible reading of the applicable law, however. The standard that the company, the division, and the consumer advocate apply is the default standard, the one that the Public Service Commission would have applied if the legislature had not spoken in Senate Bill 208. But if this is how the legislature wanted RMP's proposal to be evaluated, the legislature would not have been moved to articulate a different standard in Senate Bill 208 and apply it specifically to a net metering program, quote unquote. SB 208 requires that to do anything with net metering programs, that is, change existing tariff, place those in a new tariff, or reject, the Public Service Commission must first determine, quote, whether costs, neither to the company or other customers, will exceed the benefits. The term costs, quote unquote, is limited only by specifying that they are those of the company or other customers. The term benefits is not modified or narrowed in any way. Section 5415, which SB 208 amends, has an extensive list of definitions, but it has no narrowed or technical definition of benefits. If a narrowed or technical definition of benefits were intended, one would think that the narrowed or technical definition would have been included there. The only plausible reading of SB 208 is that it is an instruction to the Public Service Commission to base any action that it takes with respect to net metering programs on a cost after a cost-benefit analysis, in which the term benefits is generic and common sense. In other words, not restricted by anything other than the benefits' relevance to net metering. It's hard to see how the Public Service Commission could take any action with respect to this net metering surcharge without first holding a full hearing on its costs and benefits, including all relevant environmental and health benefits. The consumer advocate, however, has taken the position that the benefits of net metering are likely to be so far below its costs that the surcharge could be adopted now to lock in the policy, and its size can be trued up in a subsequent proceeding. This is a remarkable assertion. It may be difficult to fine-tune an estimate of the social cost avoided by carbon-generated energy versus carbon-free, but there are plenty of ballpark and order of magnitude estimates that indicate that the extra costs would be overwhelmed by the social benefits. For example, the EPA calculates the social cost of carbon as $39 a ton. Adding this to a ton of Uinta coal basin, which sells now for $36 a ton, would more than double its price. Adding this to a ton of Powder Basin coal, which now sells for $12 a ton, would more than triple its price. A recent Harvard study estimated that the social cost of burning coal in the United States each year at between one-third and one-half trillion dollars. If these costs were included in the price of coal, the price would double or triple. The price of coal-generated electricity would increase from 9 to 27 cents per kilowatt hour. Since the average price of electricity now is about 11 cents per kilowatt hour, accounting for the social cost of coal-generated power would double or triple its price per kilowatt hour relative to the price of carbon-free sources of power, such as solar PV. A third authoritative estimate of the order of magnitude of the social cost of fossil fuel-generated electricity comes from the EPA's Clean Power Program rulemaking that it launched last month. It sets carbon intensity reduction targets on a state-by-state basis. It estimates the cost of this program, assuming that a state uses the most cost-effective means available to achieve its targeted reduction. And the benefit to that state is analyzed separately as well. The national average cost-benefit ratio that the EPA estimates from this carbon reduction program ranges from 7 to 1 to 12 to 1. Cost estimates include an analysis of the net effect on employment, finding a net increase of 100,000 work years of labor. As far as monetizing the climate and health benefits of substituting low carbon for high carbon power, the APA's estimate is very conservative. 90% of the benefits measured consist of the value of the labor contributed by those who would have otherwise died prematurely from air pollution. The Public Service Commission was reluctant to put a dollar value on environmental and health benefits of solar-generated energy in the cost avoidance docket, calling the estimates, quote, divergent and speculative. The evidence presented in that docket may have been too imprecise or too inconsistent to serve as the basis for calibrating the size of a particular net metering charge. But that is not the issue at this juncture in this docket. The issue here is whether the likely benefits of the current net metering tariff in reducing the burning of fossil fuel to generate electricity are twice the cost or up to 12 times the cost. If the benefits are far higher than the costs, as they almost certainly are, it isn't necessary to calibrate precisely how much higher they are in order to support a Public Service Commission rejection of the proposed net metering surcharge. As far as the notion that approving a net metering surcharge now would make sure that the table is properly set for the industry pricing structure in coming years, there are a few words of caution. Lithium-based energy storage that is practical for distributed power generation systems is in development now by Elon Musk's fast-growing Solar City and by others. This technology is expected to become widely available by the year 2020. The prospect of practical storage for distributed solar systems is a game changer. It recently caused Barclays Bank, which is an internationally influential investment bank, to apply a sector-wide downgrade to all issuers of electric utility bonds in the United States. Practical storage technology would allow solar system owners to shift all purchases of grid power to the off-peak portion of the day. Rocky Mountain Power uses a measure of net metered customers' contribution to the daily peak load as the basis for its imputation of fixed costs of the network. As contributions by system owners to peak load disappears, however, this would remove the company's criteria for assigning fixed network costs to such customers. The technology of power generation is moving rapidly. The cost of distributed solar PV is predicted to reach parity with carbon-generated power in 2 or 3 years. and to fall to 8.8 cents per kilowatt hour by the year 2020. While the cost of carbon-generated power is expected to rise from its current average of 10.5 cents a kilowatt hour, giving solar a significant cost advantage. Practical storage, when it arrives, will make distributed solar and wind far more attractive to the market. Cost trajectory for wind is similar to that of solar. It has fallen by 40% over the last 4 years with the help of the production tax credit. Practical storage may allow solar system owners to dispense with the grid entirely if surcharges make continued connection with the grid onerous. This raises the prospect of a steadily declining customer base to cover static fixed costs and rising variable costs. Electric utilities will have to accelerate their rate increases to meet their bond obligations, which will begin a downward financial spiral. On top of the impact of technology, will be the impact of the EPA's CO2 reduction targets. There's a coming train wreck between the forces of technology and regulation and public utilities' traditional business model. In too many states, utilities and their regulators still favor large investments in the centralized generation and distribution of carbon-based electricity. They rely on stagnant technologies, and they do this because it expands the revenue that a utility can qualify for under traditional rate base analysis. Instead of trying to stop the momentum of this green power train by slapping surcharges on the distributed generation of energy, utilities need a different set of financial incentives. They need incentives that would cause them to participate in, rather than resist, the inevitable shift of the industry to clean distributed generation. The utility should be allowed to earn higher rates of return for its investments in carbon-free energy than its investments in black energy. Effective RPS programs are needed, and perhaps bounties earned by the utility for the kilowatts of distributed carbon-free generation that it connects to its system, or the kilowatts avoided through energy efficiency programs. A good place to begin this reform is here in this docket, with the rejection of surcharges on distributed solar. And that concludes my statement.
Thank you, Mr. Monch. Cross-examination for Mr. Monch from any counsel. Thank you very much. Our next witness is Mr. Mark Thomas. And he'll be followed by Robert Broadhead. Pardon me, Mr. Thomas, would you mind standing while I administer?
Yes, well, I would not mind. Yes.
You're taking that seat that you're intending to give sworn testimony.
Yes, I am.
Please raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear that the testimony you're about to give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Yes.
Thank you. Would you please provide your name for the record?
Mark Donald Thomas.
And your residence?
Holiday, Utah.
Thank you. And are you a Rocky Mountain Power customer?
I am.
And a net metering customer?
I am not a net metering customer.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you. It is my great privilege to address you, commissioners. It is an honor to be in your presence, and the many thoughtful and erudite among you here. I represent MESA, Mormon Environmental Stewardship Alliance, a group of 4,000 Mormons and friends who are interested in power justice in Utah and around the world. I must apologize. Ray Wheeler was going to speak today for our organization and had a previous commitment and at the last minute asked me to speak. And I must say the chief virtues that I bring to this task is that I am not too tall and I am not too handsome, though my wife disputes me on the latter point. My background is in public finance. In the 1980s, I worked with Larry Denham, my colleague, at Prudential Based Securities to help finance the largest coal power plants in Utah at IPP. I work also to help finance a coal power plant in Ephraim, Utah, a natural gas power plant in Springville, and I was the corporate trustee for a number of years on a bond issue that financed the coal power plant in Bountiful. I've also financed hundreds of millions of dollars of other sorts of things, low-income housing in San Francisco and so forth, which are of no consequence here. But my background, being in public finance, I think has some merit and some narrow interest for the issue at hand. I have two comments that I wish to represent Mesa here today, two critiques of the fee and reasons why it should be rejected. And I wish to introduce the first one with a story from my colleague, one of the founders of public finance in the state, Dick Christensen, whom I worked with at Prudential-based Securities. We did most of the bond issues in the 1980s in this state. Dick and I were driving out front in the 1980s when I was starting my career, and he pointed up at this building and asked me, how much do you think that cost to build? We just finished a bond issue here. I wasn't working on it. I was working on something else. And I said, I have no idea. $5 million? He laughed. I've forgotten what the amount was. It was probably closer to 30. A big shock to a young finance graduate from Northwestern. His wisdom was that when you want to do a bond issue, trust the people. If you go to an election, whether it's a $1 million bond issue in Richfield or whatever it might be, if you tell people the facts, they generally know how to vote on their own. The people of Utah are smart enough to make the decision to vote for or against something. I think in this case, the people of Utah are ready to vote down this proposal. Why? I believe, and the people at Mesa believe, that the calculations of avoided cost before you are insufficient. The voice of wisdom has not spoken in the street. I am ready to bring before you Bob Litterman, the former head of risk management. You look him up on Wikipedia. He taught at MIT, one of the great risk managers of any age. I've had personal correspondence with me. I would be happy to bring him in front of you. He will tell you, you do not have the right numbers. Let him speak. But until then, let the voice of wisdom speak in the streets. I would also like to bring before you Bob Malko, who has published 100 articles on regulation of energy in the state. He's published books. He was an economist at Wisconsin. He knows energy regulation better than anybody in this room or in this building. Let him speak. He has not. But he will tell you that you do not have the proper avoided cost calculations. And until you do, let the voice of wisdom speak in the street. And I went out on the street. She is not there. The second reason why I think this needs to be defeated, if you have the wisdom and daring to approve it, is simply by pointing out that last year in the United States, carbon-based energy received somewhere between $10 and $52 billion in subsidies. It had nothing to do with the state of Utah. You have nothing to do with this. You have nothing to do with the $2 billion of subsidized energy, subsidized by the state that has been proposed to transport carbon-based energy from Duchesne to Price. It has nothing to do with you. And yet, you're asked to stand in the place of justice and tell us that we need to charge solar more money? Let the voice of justice speak in the streets and deny this unjust proposal. Thank you.
Mr. Thomas, before you leave us, let me just assure that there are no counsel that have questions for you. Thank you for returning to the stand. Thank you.
Thank
You're
you
excused.
Time.
Mr. Broadhead, Robert Broadhead, followed by Vicki Bennett. Please raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear that the testimony you're about to give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you. Please be seated.
Thank you.
And your name and spelling for the record, please.
Robert Broadhead. Well, Robert, straightforward. Broadhead. B as in boy, R-O-A-D-H-E-A-D.
And where do you reside?
Salt Lake City.
And are you a Rocky Mountain Power customer?
Yes, I am.
And a net metering customer?
No, I'm not.
Thank you. Please proceed with your statement.
Thank you. I'm a retired professor from the University of Connecticut, and my wife and I moved to Salt Lake City in 2006 to be close to our identical twin granddaughters. And we live on 7th and H in the Avenues. One of our granddaughters, well, let me just preface this by saying that my wife and I were naive when we moved here. We had no idea that we'd be moving to a city that has some of the worst air pollution in the country, nay, perhaps the world, during many winter and summer months, coming from New England. We did not know that. One of our granddaughters, Emma, began having breathing problems when she was four. She had asthma attacks, and she eventually had to start relying on an inhaler. In 2010, our daughter and her husband moved the grandchildren up to Park City. And from that moment on, Emma has not had any asthma attacks, no longer uses an inhaler, except those times when she comes to visit us in Salt Lake. My wife and I are in the midst of a very large remodel of our house in the Avenues. And from the very beginning of this remodel project, we wanted to install solar panels to do whatever we could as private citizens to help reduce our carbon imprint. And this as part of this job, the installation of these solar panels will run over $14,000, which we've been willing to add to the project. I can tell you, though, that in realizing you're on the verge of passing this fee or tax, I cannot, and my wife and I cannot help but seriously reconsider whether we want to go ahead and invest this money and install these solar panels. And I don't think we're the only ones who are in that category. In March and April of this month, while our house was being remodeled, we had the opportunity to go down and live in Tucson for 2 months. And while we were there, we followed the many newspaper articles about how Arizona Public Electrical Service had successfully saw the enactment of a similar fee in Arizona. And the newspapers reported that following the enactment of this fee in Arizona, applications from residential customers to install solar panels on their houses dropped precipitously. Some reports said up to 60% of the applications following the enactment of this tax or fee, whatever you want to call it. However, in areas like Tucson and other places in Arizona that are not served by Arizona Public Service, and in which there's no solar fee that's been enacted, applications for solar panels on various homeowners' residents have remained stable or increased. And I find us very much in that same situation. I think Arizona serves as a very good example of what will happen in Utah if we enact a fee or a tax on people who want to invest in this very smart renewable energy that could affect pollution index, if not in Salt Lake, in larger areas of the country. And we'll be inclined to walk away from this contract to spend an additional $14,000 to install these solar panels if you enact this tax. And in addition, I think that if you're willing to enact this tax now, you'll be willing to increase the tax in the years to come. Willingness begets willingness. And it's a total disincentive for us. So I would hope that you would seriously realize that this disincentive is working against an industry that I see as the future and the hope of making our community much more livable and healthy and creating a disincentive is exactly what we do not want to do. Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Broadhead? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Broadhead. You're excused. We'll hear next from Vicki Bennett. And after you've concluded, Ms. Bennett, we'll have a 10-minute recess. And you'll be that recess will be followed by, is it Judith Johnson? Am I reading that correctly? Okay. Thank you. Please raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear that the testimony you're about to give should be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Please be seated. Your name for the record, please.
My name is Vicki Bennett. It's V-I-C-K-I-B-E-N-N-E-T-T. I'm here representing myself and Mayor Ralph Becker tonight. He could not attend this hearing and sends his regards. I am, and personally and Salt Lake City, are net metering customers.
Thank you.
So,
of Rocky Mountain Power.
Of Rocky Mountain Power, definitely.
Thank you.
So thank you very much for your detailed analysis of this issue. I realize it's extremely technical. We understand that there are a lot of details that need to be looked at. And this is a very important policy decision that's going to affect the solar market, both in the state and for our residents here in Salt Lake City. As you're all aware, Salt Lake City and Mayor Becker is very aggressive when it looks at alternative energy and the many issues that we have when we're considering our long-term livability of the city. And we truly believe that at this point in time, a solar fee such as this would definitely hinder the market, and there would be economic development issues for both the market and potential other economic development that we could have looking at independent solar installers within our immediate region. There are also long-term effects that we track closely in the city: climate change, air quality, things that we feel that really do affect the quality of life for our citizens. We have important policy goals for net zero buildings, which rely on alternative energy options. We also work closely with Rocky Mountain Power on energy efficiency issues and realize that they can be an excellent partner when we start looking at this in great detail. Because of all of this, we ask that you decline the current proposal and that we open an individual docket to really look at the costs and benefits as we've been instructed by the state legislature. As many are aware here, Salt Lake City partners closely with Utah Clean Energy on many of the renewable energy issues, and we concur with specifics that they have put into the docket as to how a technical committee should be formed, and that we look much more closely at all of the benefits that would come from solar that we don't believe have been completely included at this point in time. So again, we thank you very much for all of your work and look forward to a positive decision soon.
Thank you very much. Questions for Ms. Bennett? Thank you. Ten minute recess. Thank you very much.